Support for WMFE comes from Orlando Science Center, offering four floors of wonder and discovery for families and curious minds of all ages, with exhibits, movies, and live shows that promote learning new skills, exploring fresh ideas, and cultivating a better understanding of the world around us. Tickets and more at osc.org.
A virtual space tourism launch and a look into new space station plans. You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. The Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex has opened a new mixed reality experience that allows people to travel in a replica of Blue Origin's New Shepard spacecraft, all without leaving the ground. We'll speak with Blue Origin's Barrett Schlegelmilch about this mixed reality experience and how the space tourism industry is growing. Then, private company Vast is trying to build commercial space stations, including one that will have artificial gravity. We'll speak with Vast's Drew Feustel and Max Hout about what this space station could look like for the future of exploration. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? Visitors can now take a journey to space on the new mixed reality experience aboard a replica of Blue Origin's New Shepard capsule. The experience uses virtual reality headsets aboard the replica, along with different movements and a video from a real New Shepard launch, much like the same trip celebrity travelers William Shatner and Michael Strahan took. Here to talk more about this experience and how he hopes it inspires the next generation of space explorers is Blue Origin's astronaut trainer, Barrett Schlegelmilch. Our producer Marion Summerall and I got a chance to speak with Barrett inside the replica at the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex. Well, Barrett, thanks for having us on board.
Absolutely. Thanks for coming along.
So, tell me about those screens. Is that in front of everybody?
Yes. So, the screens, there's one screen in front of each of the six seats. So, that is the flight display. So, that displays pertinent information during the flight, like altitude, the speed, the G-forces that the astronauts are feeling, and then also major flight events, like Max-Q is called out in the VR experience, which is the point of maximum dynamic pressure on the vehicle, and then things like reaching the Kármán line, for example. Which is the international boundary of space at 100 kilometers altitude. And then right above it, you'll notice those icons, similar to the icons that you see like on an airplane of the fastened seatbelt harness, similar functionality there. So they denote different actions that the astronauts are trained on before their flight that they should take if they see those indications lit.
So you were mentioning before we jumped in that this was captured with 360 cameras. So those images that we saw out there were actual images from a New Shepard flight?
That's correct. Yeah. So that's real footage from a New Shepard flight of what it's like outside the capsule. So we recreated the interior, of course, in VR, and then we had that real footage so you could see what it's like to be on a actual spaceship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And inside the capsule, it kind of went orange on ignition. Is that what happens when you're actually a passenger?
That's a great catch. So we also train the astronauts to expect that in their training, right? So they're not alarmed, because that is totally normal. It's actually the light from the engine starting up and reflecting back up off the ceiling inside the capsule. So yeah, totally normal. It's good to see it because that means the engine's working.
Mm-hmm. When we were on there just feeling the vibrations and that effect, was that like exactly the same as it, like when we were landing, for example, and you felt that jolt?
Yeah.
Was that the same, I guess, level of what you would feel when you land back?
Yeah, so slightly different. You will feel a rumbling on launch because of the acoustic energy of the engine. The vibrations of the sound will actually be giving you a nice rumble in the capsule itself. But really what you're gonna be feeling that you don't unfortunately get a feeling for in these seats is the G-forces pushing you back into your seat. So that's gonna be the overwhelming sensation or overriding sensation. And then the touchdown of the capsule at the end, we have this really cool retro thruster system that they talked about in the video that gives you a nice soft touchdown via this compressed gas that shoots out right before the capsule touches down to give a nice cushion of gas for the capsule to land on. So the G-forces that you feel on normal landing is about the same G-forces that you feel hopping down off these steps here onto the ground. So yeah.
And I found myself in this looking down the whole time, looking at the Earth going away, but then I realized what beauty it was when you look at the blackness of space.
Totally.
Do you train your astronauts to look up and not down?
We don't train them on any particular way to enjoy their flight. What we do is we have a period where they plan out what they are going to do in zero G with each other, so they don't conflict with each other, but also so that they really kind of give it some thought before they're actually there. And the one common thing, though, that we have heard from almost every astronaut that's flown with us is that they had wished they had spent more time looking out the window instead of focusing on stuff interior of the capsule, because it's really there's nothing else like it. Talking to people that who have experienced it, seeing the Earth below you, the blackness of space above you, and experiencing what is kind of colloquially called the overview effect, mm-hmm. which is this kind of transformative experience that people report having after seeing the Earth below them, you know, from outside the protective boundary of mm-hmm. the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And are these the size of the windows that are on the actual capsules?
These are, yeah. So these are largest single windows flown in space, actually. And so each seat's a window seat, which is nice. Helps really enjoy the view. But yeah, this everything in terms of the volume and the dimensions in here is basically exactly the same as the actual flight vehicle, mm-hmm. which kind of helps the immersion in getting into the VR experience as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. At the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex, there is a space shuttle launch simulator. Yep. There have been other things like that. The people that are coming through the visitor complex very likely definitely won't be riding a space shuttle.
Yeah.
But with the surge of the private space industry, this is a reality for a lot more people. What are you hoping that guests get when they ride in this simulator?
Yeah.
When they think about the future of space travel.
Totally, yeah. This is, I mean, one of the real purpose of this whole thing is like you're alluding to inspire the next generation of space enthusiasts, space explorers to really more like tacitly feel what it's like to kind of fly in space and see that as a real possibility and then see spaceflight as this more attainable or achievable thing. And I think in the industry as a whole, we're at this really exciting inflection point in history where we are going to see more people fly in our, you know, in the next 10 years to space than have ever flown in history, and it's going to be exponential from there. So I think with that, we're going to see a real shift in the overall consciousness of humanity about what it means to be human, whether, you know, we're on Earth or in space and beyond. So I think we're this plays a small part in that, in kind of opening up everyone's minds to what it's like to be, you know, eventually a spacefaring species.
Yeah. Advice for the young person who may be leaving this capsule after going through this experience, or selfishly the mid-30-year-old person who is going to be leaving this, what they should be doing to train to be able to be in something like this
yeah.
in the future. How do we prepare?
Yeah, so our goal is if you can come and physically get in this capsule and sit in the seats, that you can probably fly to space on New
is
Shepard, which is
to me.
Is our goal.
Okay,
well,
okay.
I mean, come on out to Texas and we'll run you through training and we'll figure it out. But that's really the goal, is that this is a lot more achievable and attainable than you might otherwise have thought over the last decade of human history. So my advice to anyone who comes out of this and feels move towards a career potentially in space is to do it, because there's need for everyone in the space industry, not just engineers, not just scientists, but artists, people in business and strategy and marketing side, and every kind of job that you can think of exists right now in the space industry. So it's a super exciting time to plot out your course to space.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk a bit about your background now.
Sure.
Because you've had space in your DNA for a very, very long time. How did you find yourself training astronauts that are going to get to sit in these seats?
Yeah, I've wanted to be an astronaut since I was a kid, like a lot of people, and held on to that dream. I started out my career as a submarine officer in the Navy, so serving on a nuclear submarine, the Seawolf, and when I finished up my active duty commitment, I went back to grad school, got a little bit more training in engineering and business side of things, and then came to Blue Origin. I was super fortunate to join back in 2018 and be with the company over the last 5 years as we've gone through some pretty amazing growth. And I've just tried to go for every opportunity possible to get closer to the human spaceflight of things, and I've found myself here and could not be more excited to be here.
As you mentioned earlier in our conversation, you talked about, you know, there are so many different opportunities for people to get into this industry. What is, as someone on the inside, what is the outlook for these young people that are going to be growing up in an era where spaceflight is so accessible. What do you see the future like?
Yeah, it's amazing to think about. I think within our lifetime, when we have humans permanently on the moon, for example, traveling to Mars and beyond, it's going to fundamentally change kind of the public consciousness of humanity to, you know, for example, look up at the moon and know that there's people who are physically living there right now. And I think with that comes just a fundamental change in the way that we think about what's possible and the paths that are open to us as humans. So I think it's going to be difficult to predict exactly what that's like, but it's going to be a positive change for sure.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk a bit about the overview effect that you mentioned earlier in our conversation. I mean, we're all very aware of some passengers that have come down on New Shepard, especially William Shatner, with some of the poetic words that he said after seeing the Earth the way that it was, seeing that thin blue line. What is it like for you, who you're preparing these people for that experience, and then they come back and share that experience with you? What have you gathered about the overview effect? Because despite not being there yourself, you're very, very close to that, aren't you?
Yeah, it's extremely humbling to be that close to the process and be part of this very emotional and impactful experience that people are having. And I think the underlying thing that I've gained from everyone is that no matter who you are, is that it does fundamentally change you. And that's what makes me think that New Shepard as a program is so important, and it really just highlights that, because we are getting as many people that experience as possible. You know, to date, just since we started flying humans, we've flown nearly 10% of all the women who have ever flown to space have flown on this vehicle.
Wow.
5% of all the astronauts, period, who have ever flown to space have flown on New Shepard. And as we get into our regular launch cadence here over the next year, that the number is only going to skyrocket. So it's going to be really exciting to see what how that just percolates through general society as more people get that overview effect experience.
Mm-hmm. And with this simulator, you do kind of get a sense of that, don't you? Do you hope that with this experience here at the Visitor Complex, that overview effect will extend beyond people that have gone to space, and people will walk out of this simulated capsule with that same experience?
Absolutely. It makes it more real, right? This is an educational tool to help bring about a little bit of learning about what spaceflight is like, but more importantly, like we're saying, to inspire that next generation of kids, of anyone, to really pursue their enthusiasms in space. And having this near replica of the New Shepard capsule, I think, really helps that along. It makes it more real to come in here and actually sit in the real flight seats, to sit down and experience the actual volume of the capsule itself, and then to get the view in the context of physically being inside the capsule. It makes it just that one step closer to actually flying. So I think I'm just really excited to see how it's received by the public.
Yeah. Before we leave the capsule, my last question to you is, you know, what is it like to have your job to prepare people for probably one of the most incredible experiences, if not the most incredible experience of their life, when they do fly on New Shepard?
It's an absolute honor to be part of that shift change in you know, the human trajectory with regards to space travel, right? These people who are flying with us are among the vanguard, like the first group of people that is really opening up the commercial space industry and really kind of leading by example and showing that spaceflight is something that is not just in the realm of government agencies, but is something that we eventually will hopefully all be able to do. So it's really meaningful and impactful for me to be part of this super important part in history.
Yeah, it seems like a really cool job too.
It is not bad at all.
No. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for the tour, Barrett, and bringing us along for the ride.
Yeah, thank you for coming.
Still to come, the new era of space stations. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. The International Space Station will be decommissioned in the coming years, but aerospace company Vast is working on new plans to provide a commercial space station, one with artificial gravity. Vast has plans to incorporate artificial gravity and microgravity elements to improve the quality of life for people on board its space station while still continuing to harness the scientific platforms from microgravity. Veteran NASA astronaut Drew Feustel spent a total of 226 days in space over the course of three flights. He's now joined VAST as an advisor. And he joins us now to talk about VAST's plans and what this space station could look like, along with the company's CEO, Max Hout. Well, Drew, Max, thanks for joining us on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Great to be here.
Drew, let's start with you. You have an incredibly cool background as a veteran NASA astronaut now coming to VAST. What do you bring to the company as it works to build these commercial space stations?
I think the reality of today with private companies coming online to develop space station platforms is that what's important is to have expertise from the industry. And to date, the only place that has existed is at NASA's Human Spaceflight Program. And so what I hope to bring is all those years of experience in building the space station. I joined NASA in the year 2000, which is really when we started development and construction of the space station, and was there to the very last, in fact, the very last assembly mission, which was STS-134, my final space shuttle flight prior to flying with the Russians. But that was the final assembly mission of the space station. So being there from the beginning to the end, and then following on with another 10 years of space station operations, I hope to bring that experience and expertise to VAST in order to continue on with the intent to build a low Earth orbit platform.
And Drew, I mean, the race is on to get those platforms in orbit, right? I mean, I've grown up with the space station, and it wasn't until seeing a request for proposals on something from NASA to help deorbit the current space station did it become real that the space station, as we know it, the NASA space station is coming to an end. So it really is important that something comes up to fill that gap, right, Drew?
I agree. I mean, the space station platform has been utilized well for its entire lifetime. And I think we've all been maybe avoiding the notion that at some point it was going to be decommissioned. I think that's still yet to be seen. But of course, the writing's on the wall. NASA has full intention to decommission the space station. In terms of the race, I don't think the race is between companies. The race is really just an effort to ensure that we don't have a gap in capability and service and access to low Earth orbit. I think there's room in space, literally and physically, for multiple space station platforms. And I think as we bring private industry online to provide those services, we'll see a growing customer base well beyond NASA as we increase access and capability to operate in low Earth orbit.
Max, I want to turn to you because your company is trying to get something into orbit in 2025. Tell me a bit about what you're working on now and the path forward to have these platforms up and running and ready to take on the load after the International Space Station comes to an end.
Yeah, you know, from our point of view, we start with a very long-term vision to allow people to live in space for a long duration of time. And that's, you know, beyond 1 year. As you know, there are many issues with the human body if you are there for, months on end or a year. And we believe that very large habitat with artificial gravity generated by spinning is the future of space exploration. So VAST was created 2 years ago by our founder and sole founder, Jed McCaleb, to achieve that vision. Now, we have to have a stepping stone roadmap to get there. That's a very ambitious goal. You don't get there by just creating a company and doing something that's never been done. And so one of our key objectives is to be a winner of the ISS replacement program that NASA have called the CLD, Commercial Layer Destination. And that's also very ambitious, right? We've never created a space station. We've never operated one. We've never had a space flight to date at VAST. And so we came up with a platform and a mission called the Haven 1 and VAST 1, which is manifested with our partner SpaceX in 2025. And the approach is really a stepping stone approach. How do we go as fast as we can? And how do we actually do it? How do we create a space station and not just an object capable of having human, but also have a crew visit it for up to 30 days with a SpaceX Dragon mission? We announced in May this very ambitious goal. The first thing we did is to partner with SpaceX to make sure that we had both a Falcon 9 rocket to deliver the station on orbit. It's a 3.8 meter diameter size station. And then 3 months later, or a little bit less, we also have on contract a Dragon mission with a crew of four. And we are in the market selling these seats. Our primary objective is actually sovereign nation and sovereign astronaut. We might have private individual engaged in research, but we are already doing this as a demonstration to the world, to foreign nation and to NASA that we are the right partner for building the follow-on to the ISS. You know, it's super exciting to be partnering with Drew, because obviously to design these systems and design them safely operate them, and also train crew. We need a lot of expertise from astronaut, but also people that have built the ISS and many other achievements that Drew brings to the table.
Drew, I want to talk a bit about that in a minute, but Max mentioned something that I spoke with one of your former astronaut colleagues, Garrett Reisman, about artificial gravity on these space stations. And I want your take on this. Is there any hard feelings when it comes to having artificial gravity on these stations?
I think the key is that the space station that Max is talking about, the longer term vision is to have both the capability for artificial gravity and microgravity environments. And that's the key. So you can carry out that research that's so important to do in a microgravity environment when it comes to crystal growth or combustion experiments or whatever, those things that we think benefit from development and evolution in a microgravity environment. At the same time, you know, when we're on orbit for 6 months, a year, maybe eventually 2 years, if you're literally living in space, it's a challenging environment to work and live in, and it takes its toll on the human body. There are many things that we do as countermeasures to fight against the loss of bone density and muscle mass, other effects on the body, changes, you know, fluid shifts, changes in spinal fluid pressure. Those things could be combated with an artificial gravity environment. So I think that's the key. And when we talk about actually living long term in space, you know, there are some advantages there. The other thing, which Max didn't mention, but some organizations may be, you know, wanting to promote tourism in space. Well, space is a hard place to live in, especially if you're not planning to go there and deal with those challenging environments. So for many individuals, if you ever got to that point, artificial gravity is going to be key to making that experience actually less challenging for your typical person that might go to space. But of course, that's not really the focus here. It's more related to long-term stays and the impacts of the human body and how we can combat that.
And as you mentioned, Drew, the microgravity environment is not just about chasing M&Ms, you know, through your capsule, right? There really is some really interesting things that you can do when it comes to biotech and, you know, drug manufacturing and all that stuff in the microgravity environment. So I'm glad you brought that up. It's not all fun and games, right?
I would say the least is fun and games, actually, about living in space in a microgravity environment.
Drew, you know, Max mentioned the users for this are, you know, sovereign nations, possibly individuals. How do you go about designing a platform for living and working in low Earth orbit for people who may not have as much training as, let's say, a NASA astronaut program or an ESA astronaut program? These are people that may not have as much background as someone like you going to space.
Well, I think to answer that question, you can look at the evolution of space transportation vehicles. For example, if you do a comparison between, you know, SpaceX Dragon and a Soyuz capsule, you can see significant differences also with the space shuttle. Those early spacecraft are much more operator focused, much more manually intensive, have less automation built in. Part of that, of course, was a function of when they were built and what sort of technologies were available at the time. But as time progresses and capability and technology capabilities increase with AI and automation, we can, of course, incorporate those things into spacecraft design and reduce some of the burden on the operators. So I think in the long term, what you'll see is more capability from researchers and scientists to pay attention to the activities that they're really there for, which is performing their planned tasks on orbit that has to do with their research or their science that they've been planning to take to space, and less with actually operating the spacecraft or the, you know, space station environment. And I think that's the key. Not that we don't still need to know how those systems were designed, how they operate, but we can reduce that operator burden and potentially take away some of the training requirements for the fundamental space vehicle ops.
And to add a bit more color on the platform long-term that VAST is proposing, is built on the 6 Starship launch module, 7 meter by 100 meter in length. And you can think of it as a stick that rotates at 4 RPM. And so at the extremities, you get 1G with that design. In the center, you get 0G, where all the experiment and science could be. And it's 7 meter diameter, right? It's quite a lot of volume. In between the 1G and the microgravity zones, you have lunar gravity and mass gravity. And, you know, we need to know more about what happens to the human body in this environment, especially since they might remove, you know, you might not need 1G to remove most of the challenges of human spaceflight. So, yeah, this is not in competition to microgravity, but more an expanded capability. That's our end goal and our vision at best.
Gotcha. Drew, you spent an extended period of time on the space station along with helping build it. When you were up there, is there something that you saw or you experienced that you said, you know, man, if I had the chance to build my own space station, this is what I would include? And is that something that you're going to be bringing to the VAST architecture?
And I'll answer it from the standpoint of being a mechanic. I pride myself in work on classic automobiles, and I use that to hone my skills in everything I do. And what struck me as one of the most challenging aspects of the space station is the fact that there is wires and cabling and fluid connectors and all of these components really litter the internal volumes of the space station. So while much of the infrastructure is built into the walls, a lot of the add-on components and the ancillary stuff is sort of tagged to the surfaces. And as somebody who tries to create clean-looking, elegant solutions for automotive applications, and I really take pride in wiring under dash systems and really keeping things clean and organized, that was something that really was a challenge for me all the time on the space station, trying to clean up the environment. And I think that building a space station with that in mind, I think is important and creates some elegance to the solutions. And also some efficiencies to operations while you're there so that those sorts of things don't get in the way with what you're really trying to do there.
So cable management, I love that answer.
That's one way to look at it, yeah.
And finally, Max, you're moving towards this launch in 2025. You've got these ideas. Are there any challenges ahead? Is there something that you still need to hurdle over in order to make this a reality?
On the positive side, one of the most unique aspect of VAST is that we are fully funded to our first space station launch and mission. If you look at the competitive landscape, everybody is sort of waiting for winning a NASA award and sort of get in a position to be able to build. That also gives us the ability to potentially be one of the providers that demonstrate the ability to reduce the risk to have a gap and gap in presence in low Earth orbit. So that's the easy part, the funding, thanks to our founder, Jed McCaleb. The challenge is everywhere, right? We've gone in the last quarter, we've added 70 team members at VAST. We are now 280 people. If you were here in our building, there are construction and forklift and everything going on at the same time. And every week we have nearly 10 new people starting. And so we have a lot to do in hiring. By the end of next year, we'll be over 500 people. And then we have facilities and system to build all while we design the space station and start to integrate it towards the end of the summer next year. So a very challenging place. It's certainly not done, but we have the resource to do it. And it's all about execution. And, execution comes from accessing and teaming up with incredible talent.
Drew, Max, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you both.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks, Brendan.
Well, that's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Subscribe on NPR One, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We got more space coverage online. Visit wmfe.org/space. Are We There Yet? Is a production of 90.7 WMFE News. Our producer is Marianne Summerall. Editorial guidance from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.